surpass penetrating and perfect Dharma, is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas, adding it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
We're going to have tea, Kate?
We are.
Thank you. That was nice to get your phone call last night inviting me to tea. Thank you for doing that. Let's see, a couple of announcements. Chris and I'd like to do our New Year sitting. If we have, we don't need a lot of people, but probably need 6-7 people sign up. So there's a sign up sheet there. And if you do sign up, think of it as kind of a commitment, you know, unless there's a hurricane outside or you're sick or something. So we usually start sitting. This year we thought we'd start to sit about 7:30 and do 25-minute sittings and just continue until about 10:30. And then and we do 108 bells throughout the evening. And then we'll pretend 10:30 is like New Year's, and then we'll maybe have little refreshments and a toast, and we'll get you home safely. So if you want to sign up, that'd be great. So we had a nice sitting at St. Dorothy's. We didn't have too many people, but it was cozy. It was a nice, great place. The electricity went out a couple times, so that made it even cozier for us. But not too bad, it didn't stay off too long. We didn't have too many people sign up. I was a little concerned about that because we'll need to have a little more attendance if we're going to continue to do two retreats a year. So I thought, apropos of that and apropos of the coming into the New Year's, I thought maybe I'd talk about our determination, our spiritual determination. So when I was doing the Lotus Sutra class that we were doing it at Bonnie's house, somebody said, I'm still working on the slogans you gave. And I'd been thinking that I needed to return to the slogans. You know, in my own mind, I know it seems a little haphazard sometimes in terms of what's disseminated during Dharma talks, but I do have some overriding strategy here, you know, is to familiarize you with a few important sutras, like the Lotus Sutra, and to give you a kind of a repertoire of koans. You know, not too many, you know, maybe 10 or 15 that I keep returning back to that you can kind of use. Maybe you'll find one of them, you know. Like, who is the one that's not busy, you know? Shows you go wash your bowl, you know. Or the teacher that grabs the lantern and blows the light out to demonstrate a point about our practice and how our mind works. So these can be helpful. And I also, for years, have been always very moved and have been very helpful for me, the Lojong trainings that have really been popularized in American Buddhism through Trungpa and especially through Pema Chodron and her several of her books that she has written. Comfortable with uncertainty, she'll work those. So I gave a series of lectures on the 7 points of mind training, and I want to return to them a little bit, especially point four, major point four, sub point seven. There's 59 slogans. I don't expect you to know all the slogans, but maybe there'll be 4 or 5, you know, that you can use and bring into your life. So, and I was doing a practice discussion with Norman at a sitting. I said, you know, I really like those Lojong teachings. You know, one reason I like them is because, you know, every discipline has its strengths and its weaknesses, and Zen has so many strengths. Everyday mindfulness, And the emphasis in meditation on the open, expansive nature of our mind, our unconditioned nature of our mind. But what it's a little weak in is in cultivating empathy and compassion. It just sort of assumes that. And correctly so. If you sit, meditation, you'll find, just like at St. Dorothy, we don't say anything. We're just working together and sitting together. And our heart opens and we find that empathy and compassion naturally flow out of that experience. And really, and you need to be able to sit and trust that process, you know. But I do like the Lejeune teachings because they do emphasize more specifically some practices around cultivating empathy and compassion, specifically the Tonglin practices of really being able to be with your own suffering, but and then extending that to other people. So you actually bring in other people's suffering. So I was talking to Norman, I said, I really like these. He says, oh, well, I like them too. In fact, I'm writing a book about them. I said, well, that's great. If I thought about writing, occasionally ideas come to my mind about writing a book. And I actually thought about it. I thought, you know, we should write the Lejeune teachings from a Zen perspective. And Norman says, well, I'm pretty much finished with that book. I said, well, great. So this is a couple of the advanced copies. There's only two or three of these out. I have one of them. But I think that they'll be coming out. And I'm going to recommend this book to you. Norman Fisher, Training in Compassion, Zen Teachings on the Practice of Lejeune. So he basically takes the commentary and turns it a little bit from a Zen perspective, which I think is quite helpful. So I need to review with you, and I may not get to what I wanted to get to today, which is determination, strong determination, because that's actually included under the first point, which is resolve to begin. And when you get back on to, that's point one, when you get to point four, which is practice in everyday life. How do you cultivate practice in everyday life? And one of the sub slogans under that is strong determination. But really it refers back to the first one. But let me, so I need to review with you a little bit, and we'll go as far as we can go, and then I'll pick it up next week. I won't probably give as many lectures as I did the first time around, but I'll keep revisiting these slogans, you know, and there's about five books that I use. So this is great. This is a new one. And of course, my own, when I go through this, I go, oh, yeah, I didn't think about that, you know. Or I think, yeah, that's what I would have said. But I'm also using a Trungpa's book. I'm using Pema Chodron's commentary on Trungpa's. I'm using Alan Walls, who has a wonderful book out on the Lejeune teachings. I'm using several Tibetan teachers. What else am I using? I've probably got five or six books that I reference back to. And Norman kind of rewrites these in his own, you know, it's a little like the precepts. You get to have a little bit of a teacher's commentary prerogative in terms of how you state the 7 points of mind training. So here are the 7 points. One, resolve to begin. Two, train in empathy and compassion, absolute and relative bodhicitta. Three, transform bad circumstances into the path. That's the one that I probably have focused most on. I think most of you have found most helpful, actually. Four, make practice your whole life. Five, assess and extend. Six, the discipline of relationship. And seven, living with ease in the crazy world. So there's various ways we can frame that. But so let me go over the first couple again, trying to get you back into the rhythm of the Lejeune teachings. So first of all, it says, many commentaries over the years, but they originally came from Tisha, who was a 13th century teacher, Indian teacher, and brought the teachings to Tibet. And see, it kind of always been interesting to me. I'll comment on this. What a renaissance, a flowering of spiritual thinking there was in the 13th century. You know, Dogen was writing and formulating our form of Zen. But there were many other teachers. You know, cathedrals were being built in Europe. And it's really extraordinary what was happening in the 12th century, you know. And so a teacher was formulating these teachings. So, mind training, 7 points of mind training. So we are training our mind. This is, you know, this is what we say practice. Make no mistake about it. We are retraining ourselves. You know, the conditioned mind is very strong in us. The momentum of our conditioning. I return to this point again and again. You know, our old unexamined habits of the mind are very deep. And they frequently do not serve us very well in terms of, you noticed your contraction. When you contract, that's an indication that there's a conditioned habit there. What is that about? You know, and some of our conditioning, of course, serves us well. You know, if you hear a lion's roar, maybe you shouldn't go out of your cave. You know, you should contract a little. But many of our habits do not serve us well. And it takes an enormous amount of effort to retrain ourselves, to think differently, to approach life differently, to be more open and more expansive. And all of modern brain chemistry, brain psychology has taught us more and more, emphasized the elasticity of our brains, how we can really retrain ourselves. I just happened to turn on Channel 9. It was, you know, they were in one of their promotional, and there's one guy that keeps popping up all the time. I don't know who he is. He's a doctor. He always wears turtlenecks and looks like he's in enormously good shape. And makes me feel a little guilty, but he always says quite some really great things. And he had a couple. Well, I just happened to turn it on. There was, you know, an MRI of the brain. He says, now here's a picture of a woman's brain. One thing he said, which was interesting, he said, women's brains have more activity in them than men's brains. And because they have more activity, this is good in terms of thinking process, but they tend to be a little more susceptible to depression and anxiety. Actually, here I am, a therapist. I kind of knew that. I kept wondering why do women show up as therapy clients more than men. Part of it I just thought was because they're smarter. And they know they need to reach out for help. But anyway. But he was showing a picture of before anxiety and then after a meditation, after sitting for half an hour. And it was just much cooler. Here was a lot of red. Half an hour later, not so much red, just within half an hour, 45 minutes of sitting, you know. So those kinds of things weren't accessible to us a few years ago and are kind of helpful visually in terms of encouraging us that we are training our mind. But it takes tremendous effort to do this. We need to go about it systematically and with some real determination that this is an important thing to undertake in our lives. So let me review the first 3 points before we get to point four. So, and I may not get to point four today. So point one is resolve to begin. You know, Buddha was a great example. He lived a life of luxury. You know, he was an example of pretty much having whatever he wanted. He went out and he saw that in fact, what he had been avoiding and which had been kept from him was suffering. He saw old age, sickness, and death. And when I was in Sri Lanka, it was pretty interesting. Most of the temples, all the temples had pictures on them. Those of you that came to my house, I showed them just a reoccurring theme. Not so many statues, but a lot of murals, really great murals. And they all depicted old age, sickness, and death to kind of imprint that on to give people an incentive to practice, you know. And he changed his life. He left the confines of his palace, you could say, which is kind of a metaphor for our lives, leaving the kind of the comfort of our own security that we've created, you know, by our own defense mechanisms, one way to look at it. And he went out and put himself a little bit in harm's way. You know, he really took on the quest, which of course had been pioneered for him by, you know, hundreds of thousands of sannyasins before him that decided there was something deeper to life than maybe just personal pleasure. So he undertook this first thing. He resolved to try to understand why he was here. What was his deeper purpose? So under point one, if you remember, there are a number of slogans. One of the slogans is, reflect on the inevitability of death, that you do not have as much time as you think you have. Get to work. Get your priorities straight. What is really important? Just accumulating more pleasure in your life, or more wealth, or more recognition, which we all need. Not that it's not important, but what are your priorities, really? This is where age is actually an asset. Congratulations. Because you've played out a lot in your life, and you have enjoyed a lot of things, but you also, there's a sense of there could be more. And so you turn to the spiritual path. The second slogan is something to the effect of the awesome and indelible power of our actions, which means we really begin to understand the depth of our conditioning and the effect of our karma, how we are creating karma all the time. Every thought, every action, every deed creates karma, and it behooves us to alleviate suffering, to be more mindful of that. And the inescapability of suffering. Now that's a little bit of a paradox in our practice, because one statement could say, reflecting a little bit, I think, Richard, your email to me the other day, that pain is not optional in life, but suffering is optional. So that's true. How we look at pain, old age, sickness, and death, is what our practice is telling us, is that suffering, pain is inevitable, but suffering, we have some ability not to suffer. But the paradox is that you, and this is where the Lojong teachings are so important and impressive, is all of them, all the slogans are counterintuitive. They're telling us to do something that we do not want to do. We do not want to reflect on death, on the inevitability of death. We don't want to do that. And we do not want to go towards difficult people and difficult situations. We want to, our natural tendency is to go away from suffering. But the paradox is that we actually have to go into and explore and develop the capacity to be with our suffering in a wise and creative way. You know, we're talking about somebody that has addiction here and they keep replicating suffering, right? Or we keep doing the same things that hurt our bodies. We're not talking about that. We're talking about shifting an attitude where we become curious. What is the lesson here? And that's what all the Lojong teachings are encouraging us to do with these slogans, to move towards it, to try to understand it. Because the heart of the practice is we cannot develop compassion and empathy unless, and I've said this how many times, unless we develop compassion and empathy for ourselves. By developing the capacity to be with our own suffering and discomfort. I could just end the lecture right here. Just give you that. Again and again, give you that. Because that's what we need to do, is keep reminding ourselves of that. So, that's part of what we do. But we also, in this first point, we get in touch with what we're trying to do here is get in touch with our deepest motivation. And to do that, not only do we get in touch with suffering, but we get in touch with our basic goodness, with our basic unconditioned nature of mind, with our open, expansive nature, and we begin to steer on that. That opens to us in our meditation practice, and we begin to want to cultivate that in our lives. And that is our deep intention, to bring and live more from that place. So, we have lots of slogans to help us. We have things like the precepts. We do Jukai, or we just chant the precepts on our own. At the end of the lecture, we'll do a chant, you know. May our intention equally penetrate every being in place. You know, beings are numberless. May we save them. Impossible task. But that's deepening our intention to practice, to enter this realm of practice. Point two. We train in empathy and compassion. We see that in some ways pain is inevitable, and we try to get closer to it, which is counterintuitive, because generally what our strategy is that when there's discomfort, we want to blame the world or other people for our discomfort. And so we begin to look deeply at that nature of projection, about that strategy, about how we keep pain off, and we keep it at a distance. And we blame, or we blame ourselves. We blame others or we blame ourselves. Neither strategy is very helpful. And so under the second point, there are two major subpoints. One is absolute bodhicitta and one is relative bodhicitta. So absolute bodhicitta is what is emphasized really more, in some ways more in Zen practice, at least in our meditation, where we sit, we let go of our thinking, we become more spacious. And in that experience, I've said to you many times, where I got hooked was, you know, I lived in a community where we were trying to talk our way into connection. And I sat a retreat, I didn't know anybody, we didn't have any verbal contact, and at the end my heart opened. I just felt love for everybody in the room. And there's no guarantee, but if you sit retreats, eventually you will have that experience. And then you begin to trust. Most people actually at the end of the retreat actually feel more open. Not always, but usually they do. More open and expansive. So that's where they're touching that absolute nature of bodhicitta. That part of your mind, bodhicitta, that wants to extend out and help other people. Absolute nature of bodhicitta. The open, expansive awareness of the mind. And then, what's so brilliant about this particular teaching is the Tonglin teaching. Where, and we do this in our regular practice too, it's not like it's excluded, because let's be honest, in our sitting, we don't just sit there and rest in our open, expansive nature of our mind. We don't. What do we rest in? Well, a lot of the times we're bathing in a fair amount of physical discomfort when we sit, especially after the second day. Or the pain of our mind, of our thinking process. We're actually in that awareness. It doesn't feel very good. It doesn't feel like absolute bodhicitta. But what we're doing is we're developing the capacity by sitting in this posture to sit with it and to be with it. And to be soft with it. Because we notice that when we contract around it, it's more painful. But if we relax into it and be with it. So in developing that after, you know, hours and and hours and hundreds of hours, hopefully thousands of hours of sitting, we develop a deep compassion for how our mind works. And through that, we develop a compassion through other people. So that is included in our practice. But specifically in Tonglin, they actually do have. And it isn't, they even assume that you've done that first part. And that's why when I teach Tonglin, I have you breathe in, physically feel it in your stomach, or feel a contraction, and then breathe back to yourself what you need. So So sometimes that's when we do metta practice, we say, may I be peaceful and at ease. So you breathe in, you kind of feel that you're not peaceful at ease, then you breathe peaceful, may I be peaceful and at ease. So you're really doing, I see metta and Tonglin as being very similar that way, actually. And the same when you're doing it for other people. You know, you actually bring in and develop the capacity to be with somebody's discomfort, and then you send them, may they be peaceful with you. So it's very much, metta practice is very much like Tonglin. Now the specifics of Tibetan Tonglin is much more elaborate, how they do it. And I have taught that in the past. I'm not going to do that right now. But basically that's the theory, and that's what you do. So you're in the supermarket, you see somebody that's in pain. I saw it this morning, actually. We came in, there was somebody that was pretty stressed out trying to... The door was locked and they had to get in to prepare a meal for lots of people. And she was pretty stressed, and I could, instead of kind of resisting her stress and tension, I just kind of softened and tried to breathe it in a little bit and tried to relax myself, because if my body could be relaxed, then it would help her be relaxed. And this is true when you're with people, like people that are dying, you don't know what to do with them. A lot, all you can do is just breathe in there. Discomfort and breathe out to them. Calm yourself and let your calmness permeate the space. So that's what's happening. You're doing Tonglin in that capacity. So some of the slogans in absolute bodhicitta are, if you remember, examine the nature of awareness. Just examine in our meditation how you create your world through your awareness. Two, see everything as a dream. That's a slogan. So instead of seeing everything so concrete and definite, begin to see things in the eyes of impermanence. How everything just changes. You know, the person you were angry at this morning, you don't have the same feeling about them this afternoon. It happens all the time, right? Things change. I was cleaning my basement yesterday, and I was going through tapes. I must have 1,000 Dharma tapes in my basement. And I looked at those Dharma tapes. I thought, did I actually listen to all 1,000 of those tapes? You know, where is that knowledge? It seems to me that it's just a matter of trying to pay attention and open my heart. You know, all these 1,000 tapes, right? By the way, maybe some of you can help me figure out what I want to do with these. They're all tapes, right? They're not CDs. They're really outdated, but I can't throw them away. I don't know what to do with them. So, you know, I don't know what to do. Help me with this. I mean, we could start an archive, but how many of you still have a tape player, right? I don't know. I'm sort of in a quandary about it. But why did I say that? Because it's a dream. Those tapes are kind of a dream. I looked through at the books that I used to read that were so much a part of me. All the papers and work that I used to do. They're kind of gone. I go through my house, I see all these things that remind me of my sister. She's not here. I'm not going to be here. There's something a little sad about that, but there's something real about that. It seems that we hang on to so tightly. Do we have to hang on to them so tightly? That's what this slogan is asking us to remember and do. So, and rest in the open awareness of mind. Which is, most of Zen koans are pointing towards that point. Rest in the open awareness of your mind. That's that open, spacious awareness. And what compassion can come from this? And then our relative bodhicitta is specifically going towards suffering. Finding places where there's suffering in the world and developing the capacity to be with it. First your own. So we start with our own self-concern, our own suffering, and then we move, inevitably the beauty of practice is that we will move beyond our own self-concern. We see that practice is much, much deeper than our own self-concern, and hence the bodhisattva vow arises, you know, in its more sparkling presence in front of us. Point 3, which is the one that I think myself and most of us probably hone in on, which is transform bad circumstances into the path. So whatever people come, whatever bad circumstances, as they inevitably will, there at first maybe is a little flicker of a light that goes off and says, what can I learn from this? What is the lesson of this? You know, and then we quickly go into blaming them or trying to change the circumstance. But more and more, we hang out more with the idea, what is this trying to teach me? And then, as we move forward into resolution, you know, again, AA, I have to go see that movie, actually, on AA. You know, they kind of had it down. And then what do you try to change the situation, which you do need to do sometimes, and more skillfully than to just try to avoid the pain? Do you change your state of mind, or do you leave? And all three of those are appropriate strategies. But usually our default is change the other person or leave. This gets us to emphasize a little more the one we normally don't do, which is, how about changing our state of mind? And even if we do change our state of mind, then we can apply the other two strategies more effectively. So what was it? Last week I said to somebody, don't put anybody out of your heart, but that doesn't mean you have to hang out with them. It means just don't hurt yourself more by being resentful towards them. So this is what this is encouraging us to do. So we start in this one to move less and less from our strategy of self-protection. Our strategy of self-protection, we begin to use this slogan more and more to awaken. And we move more and more beyond our usual slogan, which is winning or losing. I win, you lose. I gain, you're lost, which is what drives a lot of the world's problems, right? We move beyond that strategy into what can be learned here? What's the best for everybody? So the usual stuff keeps coming. Fear, anxiety, contraction, blame. It doesn't just go away, right? It keeps coming at us. But we're a little more patient and a little more creative and a little more sympathetic, and the word that I like the best, we're a little more curious. I love that word. It's so not impacted with blame. We're a little more curious about what's going on here. What's happening? What can we learn? So the slogan is, be grateful to everyone, and whatever you meet is the path. Be grateful to everyone, and whatever you meet is the path. And that brings us to point four, which I was actually planning to lecture on today. But we're going to save that, because there's a couple of slogans under point four which are really, really interesting. I'll give you a preview. So under that point four, make everyday practice more and more. You know, make practice your whole life. The five, it says, part of that is practice the five strengths. That's actually the slogan. Practice the five strengths. But then you have to know what the five strengths are. So there's actually five sub-slogans under that slogan, which is under point four. Sub-slogan, strong determination, which references back to point one. Get in touch with your intention, right? Strong determination, familiarization, seed of virtue, reproach. What's the room for reproach in our practice? And aspiration. So we have a few minutes left. I thought maybe what you could do is break into groups of, let's just pick a partner. We haven't done this for a while, and I think it's an important part of our practice. Find somebody else that you haven't hung out with for a while, and just give yourself, again, 3 minutes, I'll ring a bell, then 3 minutes, I'll ring a bell, and then 3 minutes to just talk back and forth. And the question would be, what arises in terms of how do you get in touch with practice? How do you remind yourself? How do you go from just like, oh, practice is, oh, I need to do this. Oh, I need to be more mindful. How do you do that? How does that arise in your mind? How do you bring up strong determination? How do you bring up your intention to get on the path? Because we're not on it. We don't feel like we're on it all the time. That's part of my job, is to encourage you, and then by encouraging you, I encourage myself, right? So thank you. Okay, pick somebody else, and I'll circulate around.